This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call the show Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street, a virtual one, all across North Dakota this time of day. The real Main Streets that are the centerpieces of our communities are important places where we meet and greet each other, talk about what's on our minds, you know, share our news and opinions, this or that, you know, just chat. And today, we're going to talk about something that's pretty important with Jody Freyholtz London. She is the founder and executive director of Wellness in the Woods. She was in Fargo for a presentation today titled Introduction to Mental Health First Aid. Thanks for joining us today, Jody.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Let's get some descriptions and definitions out here first. What is Wellness in the Woods?
Wellness in the Woods is a nonprofit that was founded in March of 2013. By myself and some other folks who have a lived mental health experience. And we really believed that there needed to be an organization that was the voice of individuals who have a lived experience, mostly because some of us have lost our voice in a system where we're not always listened to. And secondly, because where I live in Greater Minnesota, we very well acknowledge the fact that most of the decisions about our services are made in St. Paul. And so we wanted to just let people know that there was more than Minneapolis-St. Paul out there.
What should we take from the name, Wellness in the Woods?
Actually, it was I came up with that name in the middle of the night about a week after I'd been terminated from a previous position. And the position I had worked at before that was as an advocate and an educator around mental health. And then some things within that agency had changed. And there I was trying to decide what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And trying to sleep in the middle of the night with that mission on my mind. And it just kind of popped into my head. And so I got up and went on the Secretary of State's website, and nobody had the name, so I grabbed it, and it didn't cost anything to get a name. And for those of us who work in nonprofit, we're familiar with being frugal. And I live in the woods, but I also knew that a huge part of what brings people to Minnesota is our nature, and so it fit for me.
You made this reference. Your website says that members of the staff and board have a lived experience with mental illness. So share your experience.
So I worked in the mental health field as a provider for many, many years. And then in the spring of 2005, a number of things happened in my life. I ended up leaving a job that I loved very, very much. And there were some concerns about the management of that position. And so I left under a great deal of duress. There were some other things happening in my life, in my personal life, that came into play. And all of those things led me to experience some real mental health struggles, including some pretty severe depression, some anxiety, and also at some point in time, just through my own work and work with professionals, realized there was some post-traumatic stress also involved in my life. And so I think probably previous to that, I thought that I knew everything there was to know, but I had a higher power who said, oh, I'm going to give you the opportunity to learn this from a firsthand experience. So thank you, God. And he was right. I would have never been able to move into this work and advocate in the way that I do now had I not had that experience.
Well, I share a little bit of that. Mine was about 30 years ago, but it was depression and anxiety. And the initial treatment was with pills. And subsequently, I found a better way. How about you?
Well, it's really interesting that our societal outlook on mental health challenges have changed dramatically over the years. When I started working in the field in the early 80s, there were still a lot of folks who spent sometimes their whole life in facilities, large facilities. And then probably in the late 90s, early 2000s, we came across the conclusion that individuals who live in the communities are healthier, are able to work more on their recovery. And certainly a part of many people's recovery process maybe through medication, but we also know that there are a lot of other pieces for us to move into that recovery process, which includes exercise and healthy eating and getting support that we need through whatever interests us. For me, a lot of my recovery has to do with being outside and spending time with horses and prayer. And the pill might be a part of it, but it's certainly not the whole of it. And for a lot of folks, they have chosen not to use pharmaceuticals because there's a lot of side effects that come with them.
And there was, I think, more so than there is now, but there was a stigma attached to mental illness or going through these problems in life. And that sort of gets in the way of something else that might be true about this, which is it's more common than you think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We know that probably about 50% of the people in our community at some point in time will have some kind of a mental health struggle. It could be because of a loss in their life, a divorce, a death, a trauma, like some kind of an environmental tragedy. I live fairly close to the town of Wadena, and we had a huge tornado a number of years ago, and that can cause a lot of trauma in people's lives. So we don't always know exactly what causes those mental health challenges, but we're getting better at how to support people.
Over the noon hour, you presented Introduction to Mental Health First Aid. This was at the Fargo Downtown Library, and it was for landlords, property managers, and tenants. How prevalent are the issues you were talking about in high-density housing?
Well, it really depends on, but we do know that many individuals, especially who have serious mental health challenges, may be on some kind of a limited income. And that can be anything from general assistance, which is a whopping $203 a month, to Social Security income. And again, that fluctuates as well. But that limited income certainly means that individuals may be looking for some kind of subsidized housing, and that's oftentimes in congregate housing. Or if they're not able to do that, are they staying with friends or family or even worse, on the streets? And so when we look at housing that provides some kind of assistance, there are individuals who are on limited income who are going to be seeking that type of housing resource. I was fortunate enough that for a period of time, I actually did housing support in a rural area of Minnesota, and I was quite surprised with how limited the housing abilities are, especially if there's any kind of a legal history. Anyone who has a felony, that just really wipes out a lot of opportunities unless you have a really good housing advocate. And the other piece is that sometimes our mental health symptoms may get in the way, and so that may impact our rental history. And if our rental history is negative and housing is short already, landlords are going to hire somebody that there's just no problem with.
Hmm. What was the aim of the presentation this morning? What did you hope to pass on to the people who attended?
Well, one of the big pieces was certainly telling my own story, and that oftentimes providers, law enforcement, individuals who are providing health care see those of us who have mental health challenges in our crisis mode. And so we forget that many people who have those experiences have jobs and families and pay a mortgage, and they're just another part of our community. And so I really wanted to present to the people who attended this morning that our community needs to support each other, because we don't know who may be experiencing those mental health challenges. We also know that the incidence of suicide is rising dramatically. That Minnesota, we know that 2 years ago, had over 750 people who took their lives. And we hope that will never be anybody we know, but the chances continue to increase that it will be somebody we know. So my message was briefly, these are the major diagnoses that individuals may experience. This is what it might look like. And the key to supporting somebody is really pretty simple, in that we want to be sure that they're safe, know what your local resources are, listen. That's a key component to supporting somebody. Share those resources. Let them know that you care about them. And sometimes the best resource is just a listening ear and a caring friend.
Now, you drive around Fargo, you see lots of new apartment buildings. They turn up virtually every week.
They sure do.
And they look like it's probably a shared experience living there, that you can probably hear what anybody's doing down the hall and across the hall.
I'm sure that's true.
So these are high density. It's congregate living in a way. And so what kinds of behaviors might somebody experience in one of these dense apartment houses by somebody who's mentally ill, and what would be a better response? You know, how can we better deal with these kinds of confrontations and disruptions to our lives?
Well, one of the key components that often happens for those of us who have that experience is isolation, and the stigma surrounding mental health challenges means that I oftentimes feel that I am not worthy, that I don't have a place in the community. And so a key part of the piece that my community, that society can do, is staying connected with me and not building on that feeling that I am worthless and that I don't have a place in my community. A huge part of the reason that many of us face isolation is that we just feel we don't have a place, that we don't fit in, that we don't add anything to the community. And the other piece of that, the other side of the coin, is individuals who are feeling that way, I highly encourage them to participate. Maybe that means that you're going to volunteer to do the flower gardens out front, or call bingo, or be a part of your community, and to not assume that you are not a part of that community because of your own mental health experiences. So the key piece is really to get involved. We know that there's a really important part of just asking people how they're doing and listening. That's a real key part. And that's about whether you have a mental health experience or you're just being a decent human being.
Mm-hmm. It takes a village, or I'm my brother's keeper, all of that
Absolutely,
stuff?
Absolutely, all of that stuff. Absolutely.
What tools do you offer landlords and tenants to deal with emotional and mental health issues? We just touched on a couple of things, mm-hmm. but what kind of a toolkit can you offer?
Well, when I do the 8-hour training called Mental Health First Aid, we actually have an acronym called LG, and in the mental health world, acronyms are a really big deal. But I like LG because it's easy to remember. So the A is assessing for risk of suicide or harm. Is this person, and asking them, are you thinking about killing yourself? I mean, being really clear about the question. And if they are, or if they have a weapon, or they've done something to hurt themselves, calling 911. So we're going to use that tool and do that assessment. The L in LG is to listen. Listen non-judgmentally, not even assuming that we know the answers or that we can give the answers, but just being there and letting folks know that we care about them. The G is giving reassurance and information. So that doesn't mean that I'm going to say I'll be here for you 24/7 for the rest of my life. It means I care about you. I want you to be okay. And here are some resources you can connect with. Find out what the local resources are. We have crisis lines and we have crisis stabilization units. We have more resources than we ever have before. So find out what they are. You can go to the 211 helpline link, and they give you a list of all of the resources that are in the community. Google is our friend, and we want to know what they are, and most of them are a phone call away. And then the first E in LG is encouraging professional support if that's what's needed, and not everybody needs the professional support. Sometimes when I'm dealing with mental health challenges, the best thing I can do is have a cup of tea with my best friend. And the second E is encouraging self-help. One of the things that Wellness in the Woods really focused on last year was personal responsibility and empowerment. What can I do to be well? It's not the job of my community to take care of me 24/7, but there's things that I have to do to be responsible. If I'm not able to work a full-time job, can I do a part-time job? Can I volunteer? What can I do to give back to my community? And so we really encourage individuals to find coping skills and tools that they can use for themselves to be well and having building good support networks. What does that look like? Do you want to join a book club? We actually have a program down in the St. Cloud area where we do social events. And so we have just created events like a comedy hour. I think we had one of those events in St. Cloud at the St. Cloud Library on Tuesday night. Over 100 people showed up. So those of us with lived experience want to do the same things the rest of our community does.
How receptive are property managers or landlords to this kind of training?
Well, we had almost 30 people there today, so that's good. Folks wanted to learn, and they want to learn about what the resources are. I would like to tend to think that they not only want that information for the people that they support in their housing, but it's good to have that information just in case it's my family or my friends or people I know. And I find it really interesting that we have a lot of opportunity to have booths and tables at events and health fairs and things. And people see mental health, and even if you're giving away something free, they don't always want to stop. But they will stop and say, I'm picking this up for a friend. That this is for a friend kind of thing. And as long as folks have the information, that means they can use it for whoever they need to. And I think that's good, because we plan for a lot of things in our life, and we don't always plan for a mental health crisis. So if we have the information, we'll be able to go back and say, oh, yes, I remember. That's my next step.
I've lived in a few places in my life, including on occasion in apartment houses, and some are very different than others. That is, in some places, there's almost a sense of community among the people who live there. In others, it's, oh no, very different. So it sounds like community would be a better environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so is that something you talk to about tenants?
Well, I do, and I see how much difficulty that people who are not living in a healthy environment have, and how much interaction that's conflictual happens between neighbors who aren't connecting well. And so we know that having a healthy environment is a key piece, one of the 8 dimensions of wellness that the federal government has identified as being key to our health and wellness. I have lived in an apartment for 6 months of my life of almost 60 years, and I'm here to tell you that was not a good environment for me. I live on 40 acres out by Nimrod, where our closest neighbors are turkeys and bobcats, and it's quiet, and, you know, there's a few wolves howling at night. But so I know for me that apartment living was not a healthy environment for me, mostly because I've never lived in one, and it didn't work well for me. Not everybody has those choices, though. Sometimes you have to live where you can get a place to live and you can afford it.
Well, you founded and are the executive director of Wellness in the Woods. How is this enterprise maintained? How's it funded?
Well, we have found that the first 3 years it was funded minimally, which meant that I was volunteering, but then we applied for a federal grant through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and we were successful in getting that grant. We also know that there's just a lot of fluidity in grants. So this is year 2 for that grant, and who knows what will happen after year 3. So we really do a lot of work. I write a lot of grants, but we also do some fee-for-service kind of work where we provide education and training and do a lot of work diversifying our funding stream, because we're never quite sure what will happen. So we offer a warm line that's funded through some other organizations and continue to diversify our income.
Jody Freyholtz-London is founder and executive director of Wellness in the Woods. You can find out more at MN, that's for Minnesota, WITW, wellnessinthewoods.org. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Bruce Berg is next.
Support for this program is provided by Jock's Garage, the import professionals, servicing European and Asian cars for 28 years. Located in Moorhead and online at jaqsgarage.com.
We are sitting here at Nicole's with a plate of 6 delicious chocolate truffles in front of us, and we are going to taste some.
Yep.
Okay, taking a bite.
Cheers, you cheers them.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh my God.
I love the bitter cocoa.
Yeah, the cocoa, right when you bite into it.
It's wonderful.
It's soft chocolate. It's like a dark chocolate. You feel so fancy eating these. They're like truly decadent.
And they're better than like the ones you buy at the store that are wrapped up.
Well, those were made a million years ago, but these were made like probably today.
Yeah.
You know, they're fresh.
I would be impressed.
Yeah.
Anyone can go get flowers or like
a card.
Yeah, or a box like a heart shape of chocolates. Not looking down upon.
I'm not saying cards or teddy bears are bad, but you can't eat those.
Yeah.
You don't get these ever. These are special chocolates.
They're local, handmade.
Fresh.
And it's a good way to donate money to Prairie Public. I think for guys it helps out. We do the hard work for them. We send it out.
Yeah.
We get the card ready for them.
Mm-hmm. Package them up pretty.
Yeah.
I'm going in for my second one now.
Just take it from Prairie Public's very own Cassie and Christine, who had a real tough assignment there. Make a $10 a month sustaining membership to Prairie Public, and we'll send you or your sweetie a 1-pound box of delicious cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry to anywhere in the continental U.S. Call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Bruce Berg retired as an English teacher years ago, but retiring isn't a word we'd use to describe him. Bruce is very active in Jamestown, and he continues to practice what he taught as a writer and as the voice of his commentaries. Today, he's talking about the Good Congress.
There are times when Mark Twain's slam at the Congress of his time, which he referred to as the only Native American criminal class, is quite easy to repeat and apply in our own time. These are the times, past and present, when it seems that our U.S. governing body is made up of a host of elected officials whose main goal is to stay in office, avoid real speech, and make profiles and courage a most foreign concept. But I'm encouraged not to overdo the disparaging tone toward our Congress. The study of congressional history tells a story that is, if not replete with, at least noteworthy in remembrance of legislation and elected leaders who made us proud. Our lists of the most important legislation might be different in view from person to person, but when we observe the GI Bill, Social Security, the Marshall Plan, Lend-Lease, in the Library of Congress, we are given legislation that was passed by good people with great intentions. And I'm going to add the Homestead Act, the end of slavery, the end of child labor, interstate highways, the trip to the moon. And speaking of trips, let's not forget the Lewis and Clark expedition. There's no doubt that we have had a share of what Harry Truman called the do-nothing Congress, but we need to study the good people who made up the do-something Congresses that bettered our lives and caught the attention of the world. Our legislative body should be encouraged to read histories of the legislation and of Congress that made positive changes in American life. The inspiration of the best that Congress has done might help elected leaders cut through some of the baloney and boredom that make up too much of the congressional workday. Reading the profiles in Courage might help just a few to put country over party, and just a few can make a difference. Reading the history of our Senate and the House of Reps might well encourage our leaders to be reminded of their calling, the privilege that they have to serve, and the understanding of real public service. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
Thank you, Bruce. Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about cellulosic ethanol and a new book about North Dakota's richest man. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new report from the American Lung Association shows North Dakota taking some positive steps to prevent and reduce tobacco use, but there is still more that can be done.
The report card breaks down into 5 different categories. So we get a C, A, F, a C, and an F.
Reba Mathern-Jacobson is Director of Tobacco Control for the Lung Association in North Dakota. She says the A grade for smoke-free air may not seem too surprising, But Jacobson says the state has done a lot of things right in order to get that rating.
One of the things is that we have great regulations in the state to prohibit smoking in workplaces, schools, childcare facilities, restaurants and bars, really every place except for casinos and gaming establishments that have their own exemptions and can make their own decisions.
Jacobson says while we may surpass other states in smoke-free air regulations, our tobacco sales taxes are significantly lower. She says the state is ranked 48th when it comes to the taxing tobacco.
When we look at the average state tax is $1.72 and we're at 44 cents, it gets harder and harder to justify not raising it.
She says raising the taxes can help offset some of the expense related to treating smoking-related illnesses. Jacobson says more than 2,500 North Dakotans die each year from smoking-related illness. The federal government wants to modernize hog slaughter inspections, changes that were more than 15 years in the works. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer explains the goal is to improve food safety.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture would drop an existing requirement for pathogen testing, but Carmen Rottenberg, the acting deputy undersecretary for food safety, says companies will have to take samples more often.
We would be removing the generic E. coli testing requirement and really allowing establishments to choose what they want to sample for.
Also, hog plants would be able to choose whether their employees do the first visual test of incoming animals or if federal inspectors would continue to do that. Regardless, government workers still would inspect every animal that gets butchered. A leading food safety attorney says these changes help protect public health, while opponents accuse USDA of privatizing inspections. The public will have 2 months to comment on the proposal. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And a rural county in Minnesota is looking to capitalize on the upcoming Super Bowl in its latest marketing campaign. Otter Tail County is celebrating their 150th year with a kickoff event they are hoping will be the largest Super Bowl party on ice. It's a 2-day event, and it will all take place on the frozen Otter Tail Lake. Nick Leonard is Otter Tail County Tourism and Economic Development Director. He says the event will kick off the evening of February 2nd. Leonard says horse-drawn sleighs, a beanbag tournament, and more music are on deck for Sunday. Attendees can watch the big game in tents or on a large jumbo screen. He even says some big names have been invited to the event, including Jimmy Fallon, Justin Timberlake, Andrew Zimmern, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who were all sent personal invitations and pints of Otter Tail ice cream. More information about OTC on Ice can be found online at www.otconice.com. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
We've heard the Me Too movement loud and clear. Now, how do we transform awareness into meaningful change? Join WNYC for a national conversation where we explore how to ignite workplace culture shifts, punishments that fit the crimes, and greater responsibility from men. Beyond Me Too, women, men, power, and change.
Join Prairie Public for this special 4-part live series, Beyond Me Too, Monday through Thursday of this week at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Cellulosic ethanol is an advanced biofuel that's been touted as the next step beyond corn-based ethanol. It's supposed to bring jobs to rural communities and provide farmers with fresh revenue sources. Processing plants have been built in the Midwest to produce cellulosic ethanol, and Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer visited one to see what's working and what's still a challenge.
Since 2008, federal incentives have pushed companies to invest in cellulosic technology, which uses the leftovers of crops like corn or wheat. It's a harder product to make than grain ethanol because it uses inedible and irregular parts of the plants. Three companies have opened commercial-scale cellulosic plants since 2014. The one in Kansas went on the sale block in 2016, and last fall, DuPont announced it's looking for a buyer for its Iowa plant. That just leaves Project Liberty in Emmitsburg, Iowa. General Manager Jason Martin says it's a different world compared to the nearly uniform kernels that become grain ethanol. It starts with square or round bales of corn stalks, cobs, and leaves held together by netting or twine. They have to be pushed through machines to remove the ties before giant steel fingers shred everything down to 4 inches or less.
The plant material is really tough and abrasive, so you just have to throw more steel and power at it until you figure it out.
Bigger, stronger machines mean delays and increased costs. Martin says it's hard to keep the material moving even as the slurry begins to go through the chemical processes that break it down and ferment it into ethanol.
On the lab, at the pilot scale, and at Liberty, the actual biochemical process has been solid.
What's less solid for the cellulosic industry is the government's requirements. The Environmental Protection Agency has lowered the cellulosic mandate for 2018, though not by as much as initially proposed. Business consultant Michele Rubino has been following companies' interests in biofuels for more than 20 years. He says it varies with oil prices, but Poet DSM, the joint venture that built and operates Project Liberty, looks to be in the business for the long haul. DuPont also seemed committed, he says, but after a merger, the corporate outlook changed.
It's just not in that Dow-DuPont sweet spot.
In an email, Wendy Rosen, a spokeswoman for DuPont, says the company has licensing agreements pending for its technology. Rubino expects another wave of interest in cellulosic.
It'll happen again, and this time, compared to the previous time, there's steel in the ground. So, you know, the way I put it is that generally the guy that builds the hotel never makes money. It's the guy that buys the hotel out of bankruptcy that makes money.
The Kansas plant already has a new owner. But while large corporations can pick up and drop whole industries from their portfolios, farmers and their rural communities aren't as nimble. When Nevada, Iowa invested more than $600,000 and offered DuPont a tax incentive deal, the city had hopes beyond the one plant.
The goal was to, you know, to have them, DuPont get this thing up and running.
City Administrator Matt Martison.
And then the byproducts from the production plant, there was another whole class of opportunity there, I think, that we could have had with some other companies using their byproduct.
Instead, about 65 people will lose their jobs, plus area farmers who made a little extra money selling corn residue off their harvested fields saw that new income stream disappear amid a four-year downturn in the farm economy. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks into America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, a book about North Dakota's richest man, Gary Tharaldson.
Ask an Irishman for the meaning of life, and he's likely to quote William Butler Yeats.
Wine comes in at the mouth, and love comes in at the eye. That's all we shall know for truth before we go old and die.
The Scots love their poets, too.
When I did dress up as Robert Burns, I was a bit shocked at the attention I got. It turned me into a complete babe magnet.
And meet Agatha Christie's grandson on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Patrick McCloskey, by our microphone in our studio in Bismarck. Patrick is no stranger to Main Street. He's been on to talk about other projects, notably a big magazine for the University of Mary. He is the director of research and publication there. But we're here to talk about Open Secrets of Success, the Gary Tharaldson story, a brand new book about North Dakota's very successful Gary Tharaldson. Thanks for joining us, Patrick.
Well, thank you, Doug. Great to be here. Much appreciated.
I know there's a Tharaldson School of Business. Was that a prime motivator to write a book about him?
Well, it's certainly part of it. The school is named after him. He's been a supporter of the university for a number of years. And at this point in his career, it was just an opportune time to write a book, both because he's, building hotels. And he's been very successful, and we would like to tell his story for our students and for the people of North Dakota. It's a great story. He's been a He's made a wonderful contribution to the business life of the state, and also to the to a lot of charities and nonprofits.
How did the book release party go? Because it was yesterday on the campus, right?
It was, and you know, we had good weather, which you never know in North Dakota in November. We had great weather. We had well over 200 people, and we had both young entrepreneurs, chamber people, students. And even people from Daisy, North Dakota, where Gary grew up, and you know, various people, including the granddaughter of one of the first people who worked for as a teenager, who came up and said hi, which is terrific.
Well, you've done a deep dive into Gary Tharaldson's story, so let's talk about growing up in tiny Daisy, North Dakota. How did his childhood shape his destiny?
Well, he certainly learned to appreciate business and money. His parents were not wealthy at all. They didn't even have a car when he was growing up. Six kids, very small house, no running water, living in tiny Daisy, North Dakota. But Gary did have a good fortune in – well, very good parents, good upbringing in terms of values and loving family. He also worked for 2 years. He spent 2 years in high school living and working for two different farmers. And he learned not only how to get up at 4:30 in the morning and milk cows, but more importantly, they were very entrepreneurial people who would talk to him at length about their big plans and buying land and building their own farm business up. And that got him into the mode of thinking about business and thinking that, yeah, you know, this is the way to go. Wasn't what he did. Yeah, initially, he actually graduated from Valley City State College and was a high school teacher for 2 years.
And taught in Leonard, North Dakota, as a matter of fact. And exactly. Then he started selling insurance.
He did in the summers and soon realized that in, you know, 2 or 3 months in the summer, he was making more than all year at teaching high school. And he was enjoying it.
Yeah. Or in broadcasting, I suspect, as well. Yeah. But after selling insurance, or while he was selling insurance, he started flipping houses. So mm-hmm. he starts broadening his entrepreneurial horizons.
Correct. Yeah. Well, he eventually got into it as a tax shelter. Taxes were very high at that point, and he needed some way of mitigating that. And he started investing in real estate first, like you said, apartment buildings, houses, then into buying. He bought two hotels, one in Valley City, one in Devil's Lake, and then with some construction experience, he started building hotels, which was the real start of the whole thing.
Well, let's talk about that. How did he get started in the hospitality industry that eventually made him one of the largest property holders in the country?
Well, he would say, you know, to some extent by accident. He kind of bought the two hotels. He liked the fact that he didn't have to deal with tenants, because if you have a bad customer in a hotel, they leave the next day. So mm-hmm. so there's a, you know, you don't have to deal with that. But most importantly, it turned out to be, you know, a pretty profitable business. It was good from a tax point of view. When he started building them, that's when his eyes really started opening to the fact that at that time there was a tremendous need for new, clean hotels. The nation's highway system had been completed not too long before, so there was a lot of opportunity. So he was building throughout the Midwest, and you know, land prices were not expensive. Building a simple 60-room hotel was not that expensive, and there wasn't a lot of competition at the time. So he had a pretty open slate to work on to build his first several hundred hotels.
And that experience actually informed him about what would make it a better property. I mean, he made innovations, didn't he?
Indeed. He revolutionized the entire industry. He started off with budget hotels and moved into economy and into extended stay. So really the sweet spot of the market, the middle of the market. But he was the kind of guy that would spend a lot of time thinking about how to make it better, how to make it more profitable, how to make it serve the customer better. And a lot of the things that you take for granted today, like breakfast in a hotel, it was his innovation. They used to build motels with swimming pools on the outside.
A little odd
in North Dakota.
Latitude, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is it a skating rink or a swimming pool, you know? And he did a lot of just commonsensical things. He put corridors inside, swimming pools. Put laundry behind the front desk, which might seem like an odd place to put laundry for the hotel, but the night clerk could do the laundry, would save money. And he started with nothing, literally, and he, you know, using his own equity, he didn't have partners, so he had to make his hotels profitable quickly and to generate enough equity that he could then open more hotels.
And he knew how to get attention. I mean, people who've been in broadcasting as long as I have, or almost, recall around the holidays every year, there would be a public service announcement about Tharaldson Properties, their motels in North Dakota and Minnesota, mm-hmm. where they would open them up to people who needed a place, who were visiting a family member in the hospital or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that was one of the – well, there's always been a big charitable side to Gary and his whole company, and that was one of them. It's not a busy time of year anyway, so why not make it available for people?
Well, he eventually actually moved out of the state. He moved to Las Vegas. I understand he lives back in Fargo now, but correct. He spent a lot of time in Las Vegas wheeling and dealing there from about 1999 on.
He did. He does like a warm climate. And, his business was moving out of North Dakota as it grew. He was going into bigger markets in a lot of states like Texas and California, so Las Vegas is a lot closer, of course. And he built a number of properties in Vegas and still is. Interestingly, one of the things he does, which is, you know, you think of Las Vegas, those gigantic hotels, wherever he's gone, he's underbuilt. which has been a key to his success. So he's able to build for less money, run it for less personnel, less money, and do very well because he'd have 80, 90% occupancy rights.
Well, one element or theme of your book that sort of runs through it is the brink he came to in 2012 when the housing bubble collapsed and he was on the brink of bankruptcy.
Some of his lawyers were telling him that. His wife said, "Gary, that's just not you. Let's get different lawyers." So he went to see her lawyer and they worked it out. They said, "Look, you're going to pay people back anyway. There's really no point in doing that. You just have to hang on and work it out." And he did. He talks at length about building relationships with bankers and talking to them and working it through. He had in 2006 sold 140 hotels for $1.3 billion and had about 700 in cash after all the debts were paid.
That's million.
Million, yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's an unimaginable amount for most of us. And he started investing in land, raw land, instead of – it was really too much money to buy hotels here and there. So he's buying land for development, which made sense at the time. But what he didn't know was the big recession was coming, and real estate was one of the hardest hit areas. And the trouble with raw land is you have to spend a lot of money to title it and sell it. It's not even like a hotel that you can sell as is. Ironically, the hotels that he had sold did very well during the recession because he builds them for bad times as well as good.
Well, some raw land he bought near Phoenix certainly seemed to be on top of a true bonanza for that very dry part of the country.
Right. Well, that's one of the sort of Midas touches that he has, that 15,000 acres of farmland in the Harquahala Valley near Phoenix. He didn't know that when he bought it, it was productive farmland. But after things were starting to go south, he was informed that underneath that land is about at least $1 billion worth of water in an aquifer, and there's actually a canal that runs right by there to feed Phoenix. So that whole thing is still in process of being developed. But it turns out that he stumbled upon something that eventually will be quite profitable.
Well, his hospitality business started in North Dakota. He doesn't have any motels in the state anymore, but he does have Tharaldson Ethanol in Castleton. And how's that doing?
It's doing well. It had a rough beginning, but it's doing well now. It opened when Gary was planning to open it, it looked like a great deal because the profit on a gallon of ethanol was about a dollar. And it was badly needed, and the farmers sure love it. I mean, 90% of the corn comes from the area, so it stabilizes a lot of farming operations. Problem is, by the time they open it, corn prices have gone up, ethanol prices have gone down, so he's down to 10 cents a gallon if you could produce it. And that was a problem because part of the manufacturing stuff, equipment didn't work, and it took a tough year or so to sort all that out. But currently it's doing well.
Yeah, the corn prices are probably a little friendlier to ethanol production these days. And he just he marked his 1 billionth gallon of production in April of 2017. So things are going very well there. You've written this book, The Open Secrets of Success, The Gary Tharaldson Story. This is Patrick McCloskey, Director of Research and Publication at the University of Mary and the publisher of the book. You wrote a chapter on his worst decision, a chapter on his best decision. Capsulize those for us.
His best decision, in his view, was creating an ESOP for his employees.
Employee stock ownership plan.
Correct. So through the 1990s, he was building at a furious pace, up to 45 hotels a year. Everybody's working really well, really hard. They're building this tremendous company. And Gary started thinking about all the people. I mean, hospitality is a very labor-intensive business, and you have all kinds of people working basically a little above a minimum wage, cleaning rooms and so on and so forth. And he knew these people could not save money for retirement. Plus, higher up on the chain, he didn't like how much they were going to be able to retire on, up to his managers. So he created the ESOP, sold 214 hotels to the ESOP in 1999, zero money down. The entire enterprise was independently valued at $1 billion. And he took a note for $450 million, which was the outstanding equity of the equity, and gave it over to them totally free. And over the next 15 years, out of the profits of running those hotels, his employees generated a well over $600 million profit, which – so when they sold it, that's how much went to the employees. So, you know, the housekeepers ended up making probably as much in the AESOP as they'd made through their whole careers. There were 90 millionaires created, hundreds of people well into six figures.
Oh, that's a darn good decision. What about that worst one?
Well, the worst one came with that because unfortunately the AESOP – well, Gary's trying to work out with his – he's planning a new AESOP how to avoid this, but there was opportunistic lawsuits made on the AESOP which held up the sale and was painful for Gary because he was really trying to do a good thing for his employees. And he had 10 years of litigation to fight through to finally be able to settle this. It didn't really hurt him financially, but it did hurt his employees. They lost a considerable amount because of this.
Besides his passion for business, Gary Tharaldson famously has a passion for softball.
He does.
And you write about that a fair amount.
Yeah, I was. I didn't know how much to write about it in the book, but then I realized, you know, it shows his character because he's so competitive. He just loves to win, loves to play, and puts his whole heart into it. And he was really the team strategist and kind of manager. He would say he was not the best player, but he loved. He had a good record, but loved to play. And it was, he said, the one thing I do for myself. Everything else he does for his company, for his family, for his kids. It's the one area of his life where he just went off and did things for himself. However, it was through that he met his wife Connie. So a lot of good things did happen.
Well, my son told me that he really loved playing for Gary Tharaldson's team. He played with Gary's son, Matt, on a softball team when he was a lot younger, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And the passion for softball was very evident at that time. What lessons did your research into Tharaldson's life offer you?
Well, for one thing, keeping a positive attitude no matter what you're up against is something that helped him a great deal, especially through hard times. Sticking with problems a long time. In other words, he focused in on how to make everything better in his operation and stuck with every little detail until he figured out how to make it work better, work more profitably. Treat the people you work with really well. And that was something he'd learned from the Marriotts and did it himself in his company. And that certainly builds a good company, good camaraderie. He worked with his competitors. You know, I call it open secrets of success because he was totally open with the people he was competing against. You know, they would call him and ask him, how do you do this? How do you make your hotels run so well and so profitably? And he would share in great detail with people that were building hotels in the same arena. But he said, look, I can always do it better, and it's a big country. We can all be successful. That created a camaraderie among in that whole arena that was, you know, among franchises and the hotel industry that was remarkable because they're all very competitive people.
Well, he's certainly old enough to retire, but it doesn't sound like he's retiring.
No. He says he never will because he's having too much fun. He loves to make deals. He loves to build things. He loves the fact that he'll be hiring 500 people a year for the next several years as he builds and changing lives.
Because he's still building motels, huh?
Yes. He'll open 12 this year. He's about 20 in production. He'll build 60 to 80 over the next several years. And, you know, so it's really his third hospitality empire, which will be for a long time.
All right. Well, this is Patrick McCloskey, Director of Research and Publication at the University of Mary and author of the new book, Open Secrets of Success, The Gary Tharaldson Story. And we should mention that Jerry Anderson worked as art director on this book as well, as he's collaborated with you otherwise.
Always with Jerry. He's a fantastic photographer, a graphic designer. He designs the book and the magazine and does a spectacular job.
All right. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Doug. Appreciate it.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 24th. After North and South Dakota became states, everyone from Dakota homesteaders to congressmen wanted to know where was the boundary. They knew it was the seventh standard parallel, but where exactly was that? John Pickler was one of many people who influenced the effort to survey and mark the Dakota's boundary. It was 1890, and he was South Dakota's congressional representative. He had previously been elected as a territorial legislator after moving to the area from Iowa, where he had also been a legislator and a Civil War soldier. Pickler was a member of the House Committee on Public Lands, and he wrote a favorable report of the legislation to fund a survey for the border, saying, "It is important in defining the territorial jurisdiction of the courts, in describing the location of post offices, and that the citizens settling near the boundary line between the states of North Dakota and South Dakota may be able to determine with certainty their location, and that the permanent boundary between the said states be fixed." Another congressman argued that the states should survey their own boundaries, not the federal government. But Pickler managed to convince Congress that the feds had a vested interest in knowing where the line of the seventh standard parallel was. In addition to post offices and courts, the line ran through thousands of acres of federal land open to homesteading. Senate Bill 3089 passed the House and Senate in September of 1890 and was signed by President Benjamin Harrison. The project to survey and mark the border that ran from Minnesota to Montana was then bid upon and awarded to a renowned surveyor whose team battled the elements and topography to install over 700 7-foot quartzite monuments every half mile. As for Pickler, he served in the House until 1897. He was also a key supporter of women's suffrage. He was born on this date in 1844 in Indiana, and died in 1910 in South Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
When confession and forgiveness are both so central to evangelical belief, how to differentiate between sexual sin and crime?
If I highlight how bad I was, then the story of the grace and forgiveness that God offers is all the more amazing.
Balancing redemption and accountability in evangelical churches this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered begins at 4 Central, 3 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll share an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show with film buffs Matt Olean and Greg Carlson discussing current trends in the movie industry and the art of movie reviewing. Also tomorrow, history professor Tom Easern will voice his Plainsfolk essay. This one will be titled Dauntless. And Chuck Lura's Natural North Dakota essay will be about an upcoming astronomical trifecta. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.